Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Remember the name Nevist Coleman? Nevist Coleman was all over the news a week ago. He's a, I was about to say, young African-American, but he's actually a middle-aged black man who was recently released from jail. He's one of the grounds crew at Guaranteed Rate Field for the White Sox. He was wrongly jailed for a couple of decades. DNA tests have since exonerated him. And it was a nice story because the White Sox said, hey, we still got your job back. And he's such a good guy. He seems to be so great about it. And I had a million questions when that story broke. Now, the guy that was representing him was away for a while, but he's back and he's in our studio. So we asked Russell Ainsworth, a partner at, say the name of the firm?
Lovey and Lovey,
to join us. He's also part of the Exoneration Project, which got him released. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, John.
The crime for which he was committed was so terrible, I don't really want us to describe it, but it was a rape and a murder of a young woman. How was it that he was convicted of that crime?
The woman's body was found in the basement of Nevis Coleman's family's apartment building.
He was there for a birthday party of his sister.
He had been to a gathering of people next door. He saw the victim a few weeks before, and then her body was found in his basement, and he was one of the people who discovered her body in an abandoned basement.
So then they questioned him about it? Naturally, I suppose.
They questioned him, and they released him. And he went back home, and then in the middle of the night, he was picked up again by police detectives who have a notorious history of abusing suspects and gaining confessions. 1994.
So they then haul him back in for questioning, and he eventually confesses to it, right?
And he was 25 years old, living in Englewood, in a time when it was a very turbulent area. Nevis Coleman had never been arrested before. He had no convictions.
Was he working for the Sox at the time? Did he have a job?
He was working full-time as a groundskeeper for the White Sox. He had that job for 2 years. You know, he had worked consistently since graduating high school, 7 years employment.
Why did he confess to it?
So he was abused during his interrogation. He was beaten. He was called the N-word. He was told that he was made to believe that the only way out of that room was to cooperate with the detectives.
That came up in the Tribune story. Comment on this. So what they evidently tell these guys is, look, just sign this piece of paper, you know, or we'll write something and you sign it, or tell us something and dictate it and we'll. But it's almost as if it's make-believe. Just do that, and then we'll all be able to go home. But they don't maybe necessarily explain to them that when you do this, you're going to go away to jail for a long time.
What they lead the person to believe is that they need a witness to tell on other people. And if Nevis Coleman cooperates and he does the role that they want him to play, then he can go home. They're really looking at other guys. And so they get Nevis Coleman to implicate two other men and himself in so doing, and he's told that he's going to go home if he does this.
Was there a trial then for him? Or since he's confessed, there's no trial? What happens?
So then he had a trial by jury, and the confession was introduced to him, and that was the only evidence.
Oh, so he didn't plead guilty, even though he had confessed. Well, now that's a conundrum, isn't it?
He was facing the death penalty. And I'll tell you this, John, something about Nevis Coleman. Even though he was convicted of this horrific rape murder, even after he was convicted, 30 people came to his sentencing hearing. Friends, clergy, family members, coworkers, all to speak on his behalf, all to speak to his character, his good nature, even after he'd been convicted of this horrible crime. Because they knew he wasn't the kind of person who would do this thing.
How long was he sentenced?
He was given natural life in prison.
Then why, 23 years later, does DNA evidence that exonerates him surface?
So the DNA was always there. But back in 1994, we didn't have the capacity to test everywhere we would want to test now. And so places that were tested now included the underwear of the victim, her sweater that she was wearing, DNA from underneath her fingernails. And we look at DNA underneath her fingernails because that's often a clue of the attacker.
And did they find a match?
And they did find a match. It all excluded Nevis Coleman, excluded his co-defendant, and it implicated a man who had committed at least three other rapes.
Is that man in jail?
That man is not in jail.
That man is maybe free today?
Maybe free today.
But the DNA that they got from her fingernails and on her clothes and on her body elsewhere was all consistent. It was one single person. So she's fighting somebody off, and they have semen or something else.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. What was the trial like then? I mean, if all they had was this confession that may have been forced, he's pleading not guilty. They didn't have eyewitnesses to him doing it, not honest ones. What was the trial like?
So the trial was essentially that the body was discovered in, you know, the building in which, you know, it's undisputed that his family lived. And he had access to that basement, and that he had confessed to doing this. And oftentimes, because the crime was so gruesome, juries want to hold somebody responsible. And here they have, you know, words from Nevis Coleman's old mouth.
Well, what was his motive? Well, I wonder how they would say, why would he do it?
And that's the thing. You know, the confession is silent about the motive for this crime.
If I'm sitting in the jury pool, I have a luxury now that they didn't. And I'm sure those were good people who were trying to do just, but I think, why would a guy throw away his life and randomly rape and murder somebody? That just doesn't make sense.
What you're missing is that in the last 25 years, we have learned that false confessions do happen. That's something that in 1994, the jury pool didn't really know about.
How wonderful that they keep the DNA.
Yeah, well, in some cases, they don't. It really depends on how the evidence is stored and how robust the evidence sample is.
Still then, but tell me then what got the ball rolling again 2 decades later?
So Daryl Fulton wrote a letter to the state attorney's office.
Recently?
A
couple years ago?
Probably in about 2014, 2015. But with Kim Fox's election, she took a new look at this case. And I got involved because the DNA would be equally applicable to Nevis Coleman. And so the Exoneration Project agreed to represent Mr. Coleman pro bono because we looked at these facts. We said, there is no way that a guy who has no criminal history, his first crime is a first-degree murder and rape. That just doesn't happen. It doesn't make sense.
Well, you could have found otherwise. I mean, let's see what the DNA says.
Right.
But even the DNA isn't the judge and jury on this, right? I mean, maybe he was in the room and there was no DNA left on the victim. Maybe he was complicit somehow in the crime.
So you can say that, but we have to look at the evidence that we have. We can speculate all day what may have happened, but if the only evidence that was used to convict him was his confession, and the DNA excludes and exonerates every person mentioned in his confession, and it implicates a true perpetrator who has committed the same rape crimes to three other people, I mean, I don't have to work that hard to connect those dots.
Russell Ainsworth is in our studio. He's with the Exoneration Project and also with Lovey and Lovey. Law. You are also a teacher at the University of Chicago's project. Is that right?
That's right. It's a law school clinic where we work with students to investigate crimes that where somebody's innocent.
So, you know, this story touched a lot of people, Russell, because it's just a shame and it's another crime upon a crime that this man goes to jail for 23 years. And then you've got the White Sox connection, and that's, you know, and at first it kind of bugged me because that was this sort of nice feel-good story. And I'm like, no, wait a minute. This man will never be made whole, but he deserves a paycheck for, you know, what we did was we took, what was it, 23 years that he was in jail?
That's right.
We multiplied that by the median salary in Chicago over that period of time. We came up with about $1.4 million. Now, I need to pause. Come back and talk to me a little bit about, should he expect any money? And if so, how does that go? We're talking about the story of Nevis Coleman, that now middle-aged man who 23 years ago was wrongly convicted of a rape and murder in Chicago. That's the guy that was the groundskeeper for the White Sox. So he's going to be there for the home opener, by the way. And you'll expect this story to pop up again. Evidence was kept, and the DNA now proves that he was not that woman's killer. And so he's free, thanks to the efforts from the Exoneration Project and people like Russell Ainsworth, who is in our studio. So what's next then? I mean, does this guy expect remuneration for the lost years?
So one thing that's remarkable about Nevis is that he doesn't when he speaks about his experience, he's not angry because he understands that anger will only hurt himself. It will not bring anybody down. It will not fix the system. But he wants responsibility. He wants accountability. And so he's filed a federal lawsuit and he's seeking compensation for the 23 years he was deprived of his family. He had a 2-year-old daughter and a 3-month-old son when he went into prison. He spent over 2 decades, and this is something that many people don't necessarily think about because I think it's very uncomfortable. When you're innocent in prison, it turns your sense of justice upside down. The guilty man understands why he's there. He's being punished for a reason. He did something wrong, and you're being punished. For the innocent man, however, it blows your mind. You're there. You know you're not supposed to be there, but everyone tells you you're lying, and you are punished every single day for 23 years straight with no time machine coming back to say, don't worry, Nevis, you know, this is going to be a happy ending and you get to be with your family.
You have no hope. You're in there for life.
No. And when you're in there for life, you get sent to the worst of the worst places of the penitentiary system.
Where was he?
He was at Menard down in southern Illinois. It's rough. It is brutal. It's filled with people who have killed, who have raped, who've led very violent lives, and it's just a extraordinarily difficult place for a guy who had no criminal background to then be thrust into this world and have to survive for 23 years. And the fact that he comes out and, you know, he's working again. He worked throughout prison. That was his rock while he was in prison. He worked every day he could because that was some way to take his mind off of what was going on, and, you know, it made him feel better.
So put a number on it.
So juries in the, around the country value these cases at between $1 and $2 million per year.
That's per year?
Per year of incarceration. That's what we've seen from...
I'm not mad at that. I told you the math I did. I took what he would have earned if he had been an average Chicagoan for the time, and then I doubled it, and that got me to 3. But 23 times 1 is maybe 23. Do you seek an amount?
No, we don't. We leave it to whatever jury determines. And I'm telling you, this is what juries determine, what ordinary citizens seated in, you know, hear the evidence, hear from Nevis about what he had to endure. And they say, yes, if $1 to $2 million per year.
So you are expecting that a jury, will it go to jury or will this settle? Can you just turn to the state or the city and say, what do we need? Maybe we don't have to go to trial on this, right?
So we only file cases if we think we can win at trial. And we expect this case will go to trial unless somebody tells me different.
I'm sorry, what will the charge be against whom? I mean, you're just seeking money here, right? It's a civil suit, right?
It's a civil suit, but
so
it's
so can't you just settle that or do you have to go to trial?
It could be settled.
But you're asking for a number that's larger, evidently, than they want to pay. So then we'll have a trial.
Exactly.
And what's that number?
So whatever, we don't put a number on it in the lawsuit.
You haven't done that already? You didn't seek to settle? You wanted to go to trial?
We filed because we thought that this is not only something for Nevis, but it's also something that the public deserves to hear about.
But is that a calculation you and Nevis have done? If you say, look, Nevis, they'll probably give you $23 million. I mean, that's just one. Usually these go for $2 million a year, but maybe they won't. Maybe they'll go $500,000 a year, and maybe you don't want to go through the whole rigmarole. So let's ask for $20 million. I mean, really, who among us can spend $20 million? I'm not saying it's about spending the money, it's about righting the wrong, but isn't $20 million as right as $40 million? You know what I mean? I mean, can you talk about this?
So in complex litigation like this, it's rare for a defendant to say, yes, you know, I'll agree to a number without conducting some discovery of their own. And the only way they can really get that discovery, and when I talk about discovery, I mean, you know, asking questions, sitting people down in depositions, and learning about the case, is by filing the lawsuit. And, you know, I say, I welcome all scrutiny. You know, talk to Nevis as much as you want. Depose him. Ask him the questions, and he'll answer them for you.
What are you talking about? What kind of questions?
Questions about how he came to confess, about who he is, about whether he actually had any involvement in this crime.
Well, this will all paint a very sympathetic picture of him because he's been exonerated, and it seemed like he led an exemplary life beforehand.
He was a literal altar boy. I mean, this guy, he's got a family.
He was an altar boy in the Catholic Church?
Yeah. He had Father Veneco, who came to testify on his behalf at sentencing. Father Veneco was there in the benches when he was freed. I mean, he's had the support of his church, his family. He has 3 siblings who were there all 23 years.
So when's the trial?
To be set.
And you expect he'll win.
I expect he'll win. But let's not forget that there are other victims in this case, because not only Nevis' family, but we also have the victim's family. The victim's family thought they had closure, and it was false. The wrong person was
I'm getting text messages about that. Here's a couple of examples. So the real perpetrator may be free today? How do we not know? This one says, who did the DNA come back to? And also, is that person implicated with Nevis in the crime? You said Nevis has not been implicated, but if they know it's somebody, you said we know who this person is, right? What's the name of the person?
They have not released the name to me.
They're looking for this person? I hope. I mean, presumably this person isn't already incarcerated somewhere, and he's on the loose. Is he in Chicago?
I do not know.
You're not being coy with me.
I'm not being coy with you. What I'm saying is that because the wrong person was forced to confess by these detectives, Detectives Boudreaux, Halloran, O'Brien, and others, the real perpetrator was left on the street to victimize three other women.
After this the fact.
Crime. After this crime, three other women
were victimized.
What
happens to the police officers then?
So they've all retired, they have their pensions, and part of our lawsuit is to hold them accountable, you know, by asking for an award of punitive damages against those detectives.
Oh, so you're not just suing the city, you're suing these individuals.
That's correct. We think that they should be responsible for what they've done.
Russell Ainsworth is a partner at Lovey and Lovey Law and a teacher with the University of Chicago Exoneration Project. I hope you join us again in the studio. Let's follow this story together. Will you be at the ballpark tomorrow with your client?
I'll be there Friday, actually.
Okay.
But thank you, and it's been a pleasure here.